Okay, so as announced, this evening's talk is about the first 2,000 years of man's history. Brother Dave just did the calculations for me. I've got to cover 33 and a half years every second to make it through. At any rate, we'll see how much we can get through of it. So I kind of divided that history into four topics: out of chaos into order, which kind of describes God's process in the 7 days of creation, how He took a formless and void earth and turned it into a highly ordered, cycle-based system that we see today. Second topic is failure manifesto, and we'll talk about how Adam and Eve manifested in their works that they were either incapable or unwilling to follow God's laws, that mankind has this tendency towards disobedience, and what kind of results that produced. The next topic is seas raging, which brings us from that point all the way up until the flood at Noah's time. And we'll see the interactions of mankind with one another and how those influenced him towards evil rather than good. And eventually the literal seas raging over mankind to erase that sin from the earth. And then finally on terra firma, and this last section will cover the events after the flood. One of the most notable being the Tower of Babel, which was built from terra firma, and all the way up to the promises to Abraham, though we won't include that, where he's promised to be given the land. So I hope you don't mind this slide. We'll be on it for a while, I think. The first verse of the Scriptures, which is a touchstone for a lot of conflict today, is, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." Now, the common idea, which seems to fall reasonably enough from scientific evidence, is that the earth has been here for millions of years, and our solar system for even longer, our universe for even longer than that, none of which fits in the approximately 6,000-year time frame that the Scriptures say the earth was built in. But we are not told how much time elapsed between this verse, which says, "In the beginning," and the second verse, which says, "In the first day." That was the day where God brought light into the world. So it may have only been a short moment. It may have been millions of years. Now, it's been speculated that there existed systems of life on our planet before the 7 days of creation, and that the earth may have even sustained other civilizations, but those were all completely destroyed or removed before the first day of our civilization. It seems likely that the angels went through a probation similar to ours, and it's possible that may have even taken place on this planet. The Bible doesn't state, though, whether this was the case, so it's largely a deduction based on things like the fossil record. It's not the only possible explanation, though. No doubt, the earth's creation in 7 days was a miraculous event. It was not something that natural circumstances bring about or are able to explain. It was most certainly a direct manifestation of God's power that brought the world as we know it into being. So if we want to understand it, perhaps we should consider some other miracles. So Christ's first miracle was performed at the wedding in Cana. It involved turning water into wine. Now, that's really no great feat. Any wine maker can do it. You add concentrate to your water, and you add yeast to it, and you put it in the correct conditions for weeks or months, and eventually you're left with wine. The miracle then wasn't that Christ made wine. It was that He made it instantaneously. There's something interesting to note. Anybody drinking the wine would have been fully convinced that the existence of that wine meant that there had to have been a well-established grapevine from which those grapes were harvested. The natural reasoning would be that the existence of the wine proved that there existed a grapevine at least 2 years before. Consider another creative miracle, that of the loaves feeding the multitudes. So Christ performed a miracle in producing bread. Now, when Mrs. Baird's Bakery does it, it's not a miracle. She follows the natural process of production. But Christ did it in an instant, and that was the real miracle. Now, like the wine, the eaters of the bread would say most certainly that there must have existed a wheat crop planted months before that bread was produced, and that the olive oil in the bread was no doubt from a producing olive tree, and olive trees take about 6 years to begin producing. So it would be natural to say that the existence of the bread was proof that there existed an olive tree at least 6 years before the bread was eaten. I think we find a parallel to this in the earth. It was created by a miraculous process, by an obvious manifestation of the power of God. But when we look at the earth and try to deduce its age, we would be led to believe it is millions of years old. By natural processes, the oil and mineral deposits beneath us would take millions of years to be formed. The Great Rift in the Atlantic Ocean would require close to the same amount of time. The Rocky Mountains would claim to have been building for much longer than the 6,000 years that the biblical record says there has been since the continents were raised from the water on the third day. As a matter of fact, there are bristlecone pine trees in those Rocky Mountains alive that have over 4,800 growth rings. And a history in dead trees that haven't yet decomposed that surpasses the 6,000-year mark as well. But let's consider creation. We would not imagine God to have created trees to look any different than they do today. He created them by a different process, but they would not have looked any different than those which grow today. They still contain growth rings. Same with the limestone that makes up most of Texas. It contains fossilized shells and sea creatures. That's the way limestone is made. It's made from fossilized remnants. So, just as the miraculously created bread contained wheat flour and olive oil, implying that it had a past history, so Earth's constituent parts would imply that they had existed for many, many millions of years. The thing is, they were both miraculously produced. They were produced in an instant, and it would only seem that they had been around for much longer. So hopefully you see then there are two possibilities of Earth's history. Either it was created long before the 7 days of creation, or it was created just before. And both are plausible possibilities. So let's move on then. Regardless of the past history of the Earth or the absence thereof, at the first day of creation we find the Earth empty and unformed and dark. One thing we can know for certain that if there was anything that existed on earth before our creation, it was no longer there when creation began. The earth was empty and without form. So just a summary of the days of creation. God said, "Let there be light," and there was light, and there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. So a couple things to note there. The first thing God creates or brings into view from the earth is light. And also that it happened on a literal first day. Evening and the morning were the first day. So what we should probably understand then from that first verse, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth," is that he put the earth and the sun in their proper positions and began the earth spinning on its axis, and so that the daytime cycle was brought into play. That's why there was evening and morning on the first day. Second day, God made the expanse and separated the waters from the waters. It was the second day. So I've got a picture there that kind of displays, at least my interpretation on that, is that God separated the clouds from the earth, which was covered with water at that time. He made a separation between them. That's what we would just call the air, or the lower part of the sky. The sky being the part where the clouds are, and unless it's a very foggy day, there's a separation of clear air there before we get to the clouds. And so you have this cloud separated from the waters beneath. So it would have happened the second day. Just another passage of scripture that I think supports that is Job 38. This is when God is contending with Job and he's saying, "Look at all the things that I've done. I'm God. Why are you questioning me on my methods?" And one of the things that he says here is in Job 38, I believe that should be 8 through 10, sorry. "Or who shut up the sea with doors when it broke forth as if it had issued out of the womb?" Now he's talking about the third day when he draws the seas together and the land comes out. And so he in essence, he locks up the sea within the beaches of the world. He goes on to say, "When I made the cloud the garment thereof, and thick darkness a swaddling band for it." He makes the cloud the garment of the sea. And I think that's what he's speaking of on the second day when he makes the expanse and he separates the clouds and he surrounds the sea with another body of water, which is vaporized water in the clouds. He goes on to say, "And break up for it my decreed place, and set bars and doors, and said, Hitherto shalt thou come, but no further, and here shall thy proud ways be stayed." He's still, again, talking about that third day when God sets the bounds of the sea and raises the land out from it. So that happened the third day. The image there of the dry land being raised out of the seas. The fourth day, the sun, moon, and stars come into view from earth and are placed in their orbits, at least by that point. They're The cycle, day and night cycle, is established between the sun, moon, and stars and their orbits around the sun. The fifth day, the fish of the sea and the birds of the air are created. And the sixth day, God creates all the land animals. And the last one that's mentioned is man. He created man in the image of the Elohim, or the angels, which did the work of creation at God's command. It goes on to say, thus the heavens and the earth were finished. And the seventh day, it says, God rested and he sanctified the seventh day. Now, rest for us typically means recuperation. We are tired and we need to rejuvenate ourselves, recuperate ourselves, regain our strength. That's not the case with this word. It just means to cease from work. There's no implication that he needed to regain his strength. So there's no really contradiction there between God being all-powerful and untiring and him resting. It wasn't a rest to recuperate. It was a ceasing from his work. It says he sanctified that day. Now, we're told that a day with the Lord is as 1,000 years. So if we want to look at the parable of that resting and why he would have sanctified it, we may find its end in the 7,000th year of man, which we'll look at in another address, in the prophetical address, I believe, and that 7,000th year is supposed to be a rest for mankind who was made in the image of God, who rested on the seventh day. So why did God create earth, and what was his purpose with it? John 1, verses 1 through 6 gives us a good summary of that. John is about to recap the whole of Christ's life, and he finds a very grand way of introducing us to it. He goes all the way back to Genesis 1, verse 1. Remember how it opened? It said, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And that's exactly how the account in John opens. In the beginning. So taking us all the way back to the beginning of the world. He says, in the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things were made by him, and without him, and this should read it, it's speaking of the Word, all things were made by it, and without it was not anything made that was made. In it was life, and the life was the light of men. He goes on to say, and the light shined in the darkness, and the darkness comprehended it not. So we're taken definitely back to the beginning of creation. So what is this that he's talking about? Well, in the beginning was the Word. That phrase, the Word, means, this is from Strong's, something said, including the thought. By implication, a topic or subject of discourse. Also, reasoning, the mental faculty or motive. By extension, a computation. He goes on to say specifically with the article in John, the divine expression, that is Christ. So this Word was God's plan. It was his thoughts on the earth. And it was calculated or computated. It was a calculated, reasoned out plan with the earth. So God didn't just say, what should I do first? And do it. And then say, now what should I do? And take the next action. Then say, now what should I do? And take the next action. No, he had it all planned out and calculated beforehand. And he had a reason for every action that he went through in creating earth. It was all to work towards that ultimate plan. Now, there's no reason to create earth and man upon it if man is going to sin and be separated from God and never be reconciled to him. There's no reason. But God calculated for that. He realized that man was going to sin, and so the only reason he would continue with the creation of earth is because he had a plan for redemption. And Christ is the center of that plan. And that's why it can say here, specifically in John, the divine expression, that is Christ. Christ was the center of that reconciliatory work. In other words, he is the center or essence of God's whole plan and calculation with the world before he began its creation. Another verse that sums up his reason for creating the earth, a little more succinctly, but as truly as I live, all the earth shall be filled with the glory of the Lord. So this is why God created the earth. And this cannot happen when it's filled with a race of sinful individuals. And so once again, we're led back to Christ as the center and key to that plan that God has with the earth. So filling the earth with the glory of the Lord seems like a simple process, but there was a problem. That's why this section is called Failure Manifesto. Man manifested that he would fail in glorifying God. So this is how we read of that account, Genesis 2:9, if you want to follow along here. We're only going through the first 11 chapters of Genesis, so it's fairly easy to follow along. And the Lord God planted a garden eastward in Eden, and there he put the man whom he had formed, and out of the ground made the Lord God to grow every tree that is pleasant to the sight and good for food, the tree of life also in the midst of the garden, and the tree of knowledge of good and evil. So God prepares for man this garden. It's on the east of Eden, or what we call the Middle East, is roughly the same area. So the east part of the Middle East. And God allows or makes to grow there every tree that is pleasant to the sight and good for food. So he's really hedging man about with blessings and comfort and luxury. And with that luxury comes a privilege. He says, and the Lord God gave the man order, saying, you may freely take of the fruit of every tree of the garden. He gives him great privilege, but he also gives him a restriction. But of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, you may not take. From the day when you take of it, death will certainly come to you. Privilege and restriction. There's something to note here. Like we take for granted what we eat today. You know, we just had a well-rounded meal, a balanced meal. It had meat in it. It had vegetables in it. It had fruit in it. But Adam is fresh, and he doesn't have this instruction from his mother on what are the things that you eat and what are the things that you don't. This is the instruction that God gives him. He says, you can eat of any fruit, the fruit of every tree. So at this point, it would seem that man was only a fruit eater. There's still species that are that way. They're called fruit bats. None of them live around here because there's not enough fruit to get you through the year, unless you're importing it. But in the tropical forest, there are still species that just live on fruits. And that's very much the situation that Adam and Eve were in. They were in a place that catered to them, that offered them the sweetest produce that was available. It was all concentrated in one area that was a very temperate climate. And so this was a real privilege to them. They were able to freely take of the fruit of every tree, the sweetest of our food groups. There's a problem, though. A man disobeyed the commandment. It's summed up here in 1 Timothy 2:13 and 14. Of course, we have the record also in Genesis. This in 1 Timothy says, for Adam was first formed, then Eve, and Adam was not deceived, but the woman being deceived was in the transgression. And that gives a little more insight into what happened. Eve was deceived by the serpent. She was tricked by the serpent into believing something that God had not said. Adam was not deceived, but he was pressured and allowed that pressure, caved under that pressure, and decided to disobey God. And that brought about a problematic situation. Man is now in a guilty condition. God goes on to address each of the parties in this first event of sin. The first person, or the first thing that he addresses is the serpent, because that was the original root of the sin. The Lord God said unto the serpent, because thou hast done this, thou art cursed above all cattle and above every beast of the field. Upon thy belly shalt thou go, and dust shalt thou eat all the days of thy life. And I will put enmity between thee and the woman, and between thy seed and her seed, and it shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel. Now, this is before God has even addressed Adam and Eve for their punishment, and he has already prophesied a redemption from this failure. He says, I will put enmity between thee and the woman. In other words, your way of thinking is opposed to righteous man's way of thinking, and there is constantly going to be enmity between those two ways of thinking, the thinking that follows God's ways and the thinking that you have produced, the thinking of a natural process which is contrary to God's ways. There's going to be enmity between you and the woman, just as there was in that situation in the garden. The serpent bruised the heel of mankind. And it's interesting that bruising the heel in Hebrew, the term heel catcher, which is what Jacob means, the term heel catcher means someone who deceives or supplants, or someone that tricks you is a heel catcher. And that's what the serpent was to Eve. He tricked Eve into sinning. He bruised her heel, but it says the seed of the woman will bruise your head. And that's the same process that Christ went through as well. So you have this enmity between someone who wants to do God's will and another person or thing or group of people that want to follow their own reasoning against God's will. But he says the seed of the woman will bruise the serpent's head, and otherwise he will eventually gain the victory over your small battle victory. Unto the woman he said, I will greatly multiply thy sorrow and thy conception. In sorrow thou shalt bring forth children, and thy desire shall be to thy husband, and he shall rule over thee. So it would seem that Eve was capable of reproducing before this, but afterwards it was much more often occurring circumstance. And of course, the multiply thy sorrow is probably the key phrase in that verse. Also, thy desire shall be to thy husband, and he shall rule over thee. So Adam was given a submissive relationship to Adam. And unto Adam he said, because thou hast hearkened unto the voice of thy wife, and hast eaten of the tree of which I commanded thee. Notice it doesn't say because you allowed Eve to trick you. It says because you hearkened to her voice. Eve was tricked, but Adam chose to disobey. Because of this, and you've eaten of the tree which I commanded thee, saying, thou shalt not eat of it. Cursed is the ground for thy sake. In sorrow thou shalt eat of it all the days of thy life. So there's an interesting change. Before this, God tells him, you can freely eat of the sweetest food on the earth, the fruits. And now he says, you're going to plow the ground and you're going to eat the herb of the field. So that's a bit of a contrast there between what he was blessed with before. And so eat of it all the days of thy life. Thorns also and thistles shall it bring forth to thee, and thou shalt eat the herb of the field. In the sweat of thy face thou shalt eat bread, till thou return unto the ground. For out of it wast thou taken, for dust thou art, and unto dust shalt thou return. So these phrases, all the days of thy life, until thou return unto the ground, and dust thou art, and unto dust shalt thou return, give indication that that process of death had already begun in Adam. His days were numbered, you might say. The process of aging had gained the upper hand on Adam. He was no longer free from death. Now, I talked a little bit about this contention between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent. And that contention or separation, for good reason, is a theme throughout these first few chapters of Genesis. First, we see it between the Eve and serpent. And, of course, the serpent gains the upper hand over Eve in that battle. The next generation, only one generation down, we see it again with Cain and Abel, that contention between them. Because Cain is thinking, I can do things my way instead of following God's commandments. And Abel says, no, I am not going to do things my way. I'm going to do them exactly the way God said. And so there's this contention between them. And what happens? Cain kills Abel. Once again, you have a bruising of the heel in symbol. Cain wins a small battle over Abel, but we know what the greatest victory will be is Abel overcame that sinful flesh within him, and he'll be given the great victory. Next, you know, the next few generations, Seth replaces Abel as the righteous seed, and his line is in stark contrast to Cain's line, which you look at this what we're told about Seth's line, and it seems to be a very righteous line, at least until the intermarriage, and Cain's line tends to be a very wicked, very boastful, very arrogant, very my way is the best way, a line of people. And so there's this stark contrast between them, and there's contention between them because of that. Then we go on and we find the same thing even after the intermarrying, but now we're only left with Noah's family as the righteous and all of mankind as the wicked. And there's this contention again between them. And finally, to the point where God wipes out all of mankind and only saves Noah's family. But you know what? Only one generation later, it's reestablished. Ham goes in and looks on his drunken father's nakedness and shows Cain and his son, and they're cursed by Noah for their fleshly thinking, and Shem and Ham are blessed for their righteous actions. So here again, you have this contrast between the righteous and the wicked. And later on, we even read of Nimrod, who sets himself up as a man against God. And at that point, we're not even told of a righteous counterpart, unfortunately. So if we want to look at this line of Cain first here, it's interesting to note a few things about it. First thing it says about Cain is he builded a city and called the name of the city after the name of his son, Enoch. Enoch was Cain's son. Enoch has Irad. Irad begets Mehujael. Mehujael begets Methusael. Methusael begets Lamech. Lamech, we're told, had two wives. He's the first instance recorded of polygamy, and he also seems to be a ruler by warfare. He's a great man in the earth, I believe it says. But he boasts about, if someone comes against me, I'm gonna take vengeance on him 77-fold. He's rejoicing in the protection or privilege that God granted Cain. If someone came against slew Cain, God would take vengeance on him 7-fold. And Lamech says, well, if someone comes against me, I'm going to have vengeance on him 77-fold. And that was probably largely a result of his son's achievements. Jabal is the father of such as dwell in tents and have cattle. We're not really told of people dwelling indoors at this point until Jabal comes in and says he's the father of such as dwell in tents and have cattle. And it would seem that the having cattle was to supply the material for the tents, though not can't be dogmatic about that. Jubal is his second son. It says he's the father of all such as handle the harp and the organ. So you have one that domesticates himself, raises himself to a more luxurious lifestyle. The next one adds the arts to that. Now we have the arts in music. So he's the he's kind of the ancient day equivalent of the modern music celebrity. So he would have been famous throughout the earth for his refinement. Tubal-Cain is probably the most important one. Tubal means offspring of. So Tubal-Cain, Lamech, names his son offspring of Cain. So he's rejoicing in the fact that he came from Cain's line, the cursed line. And he's saying, we're making a name for ourselves. And it says of Tubal-Cain that he became an instructor of every artificer in brass and iron. So Tubal-Cain brings about simultaneously the Bronze Age or the Brass Age and the Iron Age, all in one generation. And what do you think would be the most effective or the most most notable area in which that technology would improve? Probably weaponry. His family now had the most advanced weaponry in the world. So no wonder Lamech is boasting that if somebody kills me, vengeance is going to be taken on him 77-fold, even more so than God would avenge Cain. Because Tubal-Cain has the most advanced modern weaponry in the world. So this is the descendants of Cain that we're told of. And I'll just make a note right now. Mehujael means smitten of God. Methusael means man of God. And it's Methusael that has these famous men in the earth. So just a note, we'll come back to that later. What about the righteous line? Well, we have Adam, whose righteous son is Seth, Enosh, Kenan, Mahalalel, Jared, Enoch, Methuselah, Lamech, and then Noah, who survives the flood. And this is a scale chart, so each one is scaled according to the age of their life and also shifted by how old their father was when they were born. So he's 130 years old. Adam was 130 years old when he had Seth. Seth 105 when he had Enosh. Enosh was 90 when he had Kenan. Kenan was 70 when he had Mahalalel. And you add all those up, plus 600 years old that Noah was before the flood, you get 656 years from creation to the flood. Just kind of give you a time frame there. It's also interesting to see how long Adam lived compared to his descendants. He was actually still alive when Noah's dad was born. All those generations later. Here's where he died. This line comes right down, and Lamech was practically a grown man by the time Adam died. Definitely Methuselah was, and Methuselah actually outlives Lamech. He lives through the same year that the flood occurs, is when he died. Lamech lives 777 years, which is quite significant, I think. But I believe it's 5 years before the flood that Lamech dies. At any rate, Methuselah would have heard Adam's stories firsthand. He would have heard Adam tell the stories of Earth's history. And Methuselah lived all the way to the year of the flood. So everyone in the flood knew from Methuselah what had happened, or could know at least from Methuselah if they were willing to hear, what had happened in all the way back to the beginning when Adam fell in the garden and when the contention was established between Cain and Abel. And then Noah, of course, is the only one to live through the flood, he and his family. The last generation to live through the flood. And that was 8 individuals that were saved in the flood. It's interesting to look at the meanings of these names. Adam means man, Seth appointed, etc. there. Methuselah is interesting. It says, his death shall send forth. That's the meaning of the name Methuselah. It's interesting. He died in the same year that the flood came. So it's ironic or noteworthy, at least, to see that Methuselah's name at his death shall send forth, and it would seem that Methuselah's death sent forth the flood. But it's really interesting when you look at all these names put together. It forms a phrase, or actually 3 sentences. Man appointed miserable the object of mercy, and the curse made man a miserable creature. And yet, as soon as God cursed him, he offered a way of reconciliation. That's why it says the object of mercy. Man appointed miserable, the object of mercy. He who is with the mighty God, speaking of Christ, shall descend, the consecrated one, and his death shall send forth, when smitten, rest. So you have the whole plan of God for reconciliation of man summed up in the first, how many is that? 10 or 11 generations there of mankind. The whole of Earth's history before the flood. So what happened at that point? Well, before the flood came, it says, and we're not really told exactly when, it just says when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born unto them, that the sons of God, and that's not talking about angels, it's talking about sons of God as those who follow God, and that's the only way it's used throughout the rest of Scriptures. We're actually called to be sons and daughters of God, followers of His ways. So when the sons of God, those who followed God, saw the daughters of men, now this is Cain's line, it's the ones who think naturally, the ones who think like the serpent did, when they saw those daughters, that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose. And this was seen by God as such a evil thing that He says, this is His proclamation right after this recorded incident, "My spirit shall not always strive with man, for that he also is flesh. Yet his days shall be 120 years." Now, if you remember some of the ages of those pre-flood individuals, they're in the 900 and some odd year range. Over 900 years most of these people are living, and God says, "I'm going to limit man's lifetime to 120 years." So you're talking like 1/8 of their lifespan God is going to limit them to. Notice it doesn't happen instantaneously. He says, "Yet his days shall be 120 years." So from this point on, we should expect to see a gradual decline in the age of man all the way down to 120 years. He goes on to say there were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bare children unto them, the same became men, mighty men, which were of old men of renown. So it's saying these were great men, powerful men, and they were famous. Now remember what we said about this chart here, that Methusael means man of God. And I might just put forth a suggestion here that Mehujael married one of the daughters from Seth's line. Why else would Methusael be given the name that he was? And if that's correct, Mehujael marries a daughter of Seth's line, and mind you, she's still holding on to that heritage of her father's, and she names her son a righteous name, Methusael, man of God. And yet, what does that turn into? Does that hold on to the righteousness of the generations before her? No. What happens when you mix good and evil? It would seem you get excessive evil. Because look at one generation down from Methusael. Did he pass that on? His mother's righteousness, did he pass that on to Lamech? No. Lamech becomes the first polygamist, and he becomes a tyrant. And guess what? All his descendants are men of renown. These are the men of renown in Genesis. So it would seem to fit quite well that Mehujael was one of the individuals who got himself a wife of Seth's line. At any rate, can't be dogmatic on it, but it seems to present an interesting lesson. What happens when you mix good and evil? You don't get good carrying on and evil dying out. That's not man's tendency. It goes on to say, "The Lord saw the wickedness of man was great in the earth, so the Lord said, I will blot out man whom I have created. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. And Noah was 600 years old when the flood of waters came, and Noah and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives went into the ark, and of animals two and two went into the ark. So Noah and his family are the only ones that God finds righteous in the whole earth, and it's the direct product of unholy marriages, just like we saw today in the second portion in Nehemiah. What's the product of those unholy marriages? They lead to pervasive wickedness. And that is, if you can put your finger on one event that led to the flood, the destruction of all of mankind, that was it. It was a mixing of righteous and evil. You can't mix good motives with bad people, bad intentioned people, I should say. So why is the flood worth considering? If we've only got a half a second for every 33 and a half years, why would we consider the event of the flood? Well, we're told in Matthew 24, "But as the days of Noah were, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days that were before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered into the ark, and knew not until the flood came and took them all away. so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. The coming of the Son of Man is going to be like the coming of the flood. First off, it's going to happen in an instant. No one's going to be prepared for it except that very, very small righteous remnant. They're going to be the only ones ready for it. The other thing that we find out is they were eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage. They were all concerned with how to please ourselves. So you have the development of the arts. Is it Jubal? He is the father of all the musicians. So now we have a class of musicians and everyone's going to be enjoying them. Like, why would you create music except for personal enjoyment? So you can see that the mindset of people was, let's enjoy life. Let's build a society in which we can please ourselves. And what is modern society? What is the society that we see? What is driving it? It's an economy that's not based on what we need. The American economy is definitely not based on growing food and building houses. American economy is based on things like iTunes, like rock concerts, like the next new technology. It's things that please us, but not that we need. Okay? And so that signals the coming of the flood in Noah's day. It signals in our day the coming of Christ. And it's interesting also that they kept doing these things until the very day that Noah entered the ark and knew not until the flood came. So the society that we have, which is very much a pleasure-based society, will continue right until the day when Christ returns. And so we see this imminent foreshadowing of things that are going south and going south quick. You look at the European markets and they're crashing. They seem to be crashing like dominoes. The system of things that we have today will not completely crash until Christ has arrived on the scene. So what does that tell us? When we see those events happening, we're going to say Christ is going to come before the economy crashes completely. Because it's going to be just like in the days of Noah. They kept doing those pleasurable things right up until the day that Noah entered the ark. So just a little forewarning for us, what we should be looking for. We don't wait till things get really bad and then expect Christ to come. Christ comes before that. He pulls us away before the whole earth has an inkling that it's going to happen. Goes on to say, and the waters prevailed on the earth 150 days. Afterward, the Lord said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground because of man, neither will I ever again strike down every living creature as I have done. So I talked a bit at the very beginning of this talk about what the earth may have gone through before in its creation, and since then, and the reason, and I'm going to talk a little bit about an objection to the scriptures again, right here, because most objections to the divinity of the scriptures are found right here in these first 2,000 years or so. And the first part of the Bible is where critics of the Bible say, "Look, that couldn't have happened, and that couldn't have happened. There's no evidence that that ever happened." So, if you bear with me for a second, I'm going to go through a little bit more of that. Genesis 9, verses 11 through 13 says, And I will establish my covenant with you, neither shall all flesh be cut off any more by the waters of a flood, neither shall there any more be a flood to destroy the earth. I do set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be for a token of a covenant between me and the earth. So we saw in Genesis 8:21, he makes the promise. He says, I will never again curse the ground because of man, neither will I ever again strike down every living creature as I have done. So he makes the oath. Something else happens in Genesis 9, verse 11. He establishes that covenant. What does that mean to establish something? You make it sure. You make it so that everyone sees it's impossible for that covenant to fail. And then lastly, that wasn't the setting of the bow in the cloud. That was something different. Lastly, he sets his bow in the cloud for a token of the covenant. I want outward show to remind you that I made this covenant and established it. What's interesting, I was having a discussion with someone on this in the past few months, and they brought up the obvious problem that there is not enough water on Earth right now to flood it. There's not even enough, even if you take all the water that's in the atmosphere, all the water that's under the ground in springs and underwater caves, all the water that's in the polar ice caps, and you put it all on the ocean, you released it all into the ocean, the water level of the ocean still wouldn't rise enough to even cover the mountains in the Holy Land. And that's supposed to be proof that the scriptures aren't true. But what do we find that God said in Genesis 9:11? He made the covenant. He said, I will never flood the earth again. And then he established it. He did something to prove that that covenant was never going to fail. What did he do to prove that the covenant would never fail? It seems to make perfect sense to me that now there's not enough water on earth to flood it. It's impossible for earth to be flooded again. God established his covenant. And he goes on to say, he said, a token for that covenant in the rainbow and the clouds. There's something else that happened in Genesis 9, verse 3. Every moving thing that liveth shall be meat for you. Even as the green herb have I given you all things. So it would seem, although it wouldn't be dogmatic on it again, it would seem that before this point, man didn't eat animals. He ate fruit when he got the chance. He ate it all the time in the Garden of Eden, but then after that, he probably had rare chances to. He was too busy tilling the ground to make a sustainable amount of food for himself. But at this point, God says, and it would seem to be in reward for saving all the animals, he says to Noah, the same way that you've always ate the green herb of the field, now you can eat any animal, anything that lives and moves. So that was without the Mosaic distinction between clean and unclean animals. They had those, but probably just for sacrifice. Noah knew to sacrifice clean animals. But it would seem that at this point they could eat any animals that they wanted to. So you have, it would seem at least, well, we can see by God's commandment, God gave them permission to eat fruit at first. After the curse, he gave them permission and command to eat the fruit of the ground, the herb of the field. And at this point, he gives them permission to eat meat. Just an interesting thing to notice. So look what happens after the flood. Well, Noah lives for 950 years. Shem lives for 600 years. He actually dies before Noah dies. So Shem lives, and then Shem's son, Arphaxad, lives 438 years. And Arphaxad actually died before Shem did. So you have, they come out of the flood, Noah has Shem, Shem has Arphaxad, then Arphaxad dies, and a little later Shem dies, and then finally Noah dies. So we think of this as a really gradual reduction of ages, 950 to 600 to 438, 433, on down to 200s, 100s eventually. We think of that as like a really gradual deduction of ages, but when you really think about it, like, I'm not going to live to see my grandfather's death. Like, he's going to live longer than me? That seems like a pretty aggressive degradation of man's age or reduction of man's ages. Now, it's interesting also to note that it wasn't just their ages of death that were reduced. It was also, if you look at the age when they had their first son, that was reduced. At first, it would be like 100 years, 105 years old, they had their first son. For Adam, it was 130 years he finally had Cain. That was Seth. So about 100 years for his descendants to have their first son. At this point, it's brought all the way down to about 40 years. And then later, about the time of the Exodus, when everyone's only living 60 or 70 years, it's brought right down to 20 years. So it wasn't just man dies earlier. It was man's whole life is fast-forwarded now. Now it only takes 20 years, 40 years for man to reproduce, and by 120 years, he's dead and gone. Okay? So it was like a fast-forward or a shrinking of the whole life. It wasn't like, okay, you lived this long, and now I'm just going to chop off that part of your life and get rid of it. It was actually a fast-forward of the aging process. So why is that interesting? Well, there's been a lot of research done on why do we age? Why are we age so quickly? Is there any way that we could make a person that dies at 70 years live until they're 120 or 300 or 900 if you're really ambitious? How do we make that happen? That's, you know, one of the marvels, I would say, or one of the big questions of modern medicine, but it's really not just modern medicine. It's been, you know, for centuries on end, people have been trying to figure out, how do I live longer? And at first, they could only explore the organs within us. There's no organs within us that make us only live 70 years. Just everything degrades gradually. So it's not at the organ level. But then, they got clever, and they could look even inside the organs at cells, at single cells. I looked through all the cells, and there's nothing in cells that makes us only live 70 years. As a matter of fact, all the cells degrade at the same rate. So what is it inside a cell that makes the cells all degrade? Well, now they can see subcellular. There's nothing there that makes man degrade. All the subcellular organelles develop the same way. They all age the same way. So then they look below that at the molecular level. Now they can look at single molecules that make up cellular parts, and there's still nothing there that they can put their finger on and say, this is what sets man's age. And if God was going to fast forward man's age, that's how he did it. No. So we've explored everything all the way down to the molecular level. Molecules are made of atoms. It had to be something in the atomic or subatomic level. If you're speaking scientifically, it had to be something at that level that fast-forwarded man's age. So what are the repercussions of that? Primary dating systems in the world are things like carbon-14. They depend on atomic decay of atoms. So if God limited man's life, and you want to look at this scientifically and say, how did he do that? Well, it affected the atomic level. And that means that when we do carbon-14 dating, we've got to take that into consideration. Why would we expect carbon-14 dating to verify biblical events if the dating method we're using is not based on biblical events? We take an unscriptural timeline for C14 and we try to make it match up with a scriptural timeline of events. Doesn't happen. No wonder so many people try to use it to disprove the Bible. It doesn't agree because you're not using a biblical series of events to date it. So that's another ranting on why modern technology doesn't prove the Bible wrong. It actually tends to strengthen our case. When, though, we look at modern technology with a view to scriptural events, we look at what the Bible says, and then we match it with modern technology and events, it seems to fit quite nicely. But when you take someone who's a scientist, pure scientist with no religion, and they start looking at things and making deductions without the Bible in hand, they start making deductions based on unscriptural events and unscriptural series of events. And that's how they come to conclusions that seem to not align themselves with the Scriptures. Okay, so what happens after the flood? So we're in our last section here on terra firma. We're about halfway through it, actually. I think this is our last slide. So on terra firma, so this is after the flood. What happens then? Well, you have Ham's curse line. He's really a little wicked. This was the wicked line. Ham and his son Canaan are both cursed by Noah for their wickedness. And they're said that there will be servants to Shem and Japheth who were blessed by Noah. And that's for their respective righteous and evil actions. And you follow down the line of Ham and you come to Cush. And Cush begot Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one in the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. And that should actually read, he was a mighty hunter against the Lord. And hunter, the word there for hunter, means someone who chases or pursues, much like the New Testament word persecute. So this Nimrod became a mighty persecutor against the Lord. Wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. And it goes on to say, the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, and Erech, and Akkad, and Calne in the land of Shinar. So that's interesting. We have this hunter against the Lord, or a persecutor against the Lord, and the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. Now, what do we learn from Bible prophecies? Let's go, actually, we're in the first book of the Bible. Let's go all the way to the last book of the Bible, Revelations. What does it talk about in there? Babylon the Great. The great enemy of God and his people is Babylon the Great. Here's where it's established. You have this persecutor of the Lord named Nimrod, and the beginning of his kingdom is Babel. So he's building this up to support man, the pride of man. Remember, he says, let's build a tower in the midst of it that reaches all the way to heaven and make a name for ourselves. We're going to make ourselves somebody in the face of God's command to be dispersed throughout the earth and reproduce within it. So the way he does this is by establishing his kingdom in Babel. And you can follow that right down, and we will in the next couple of talks, you know, in the 2,000 to 4,000 years of the earth talk, we'll find, hopefully it will be brought out about how Babylon was the destroyer of God's heritage in Judah, the destroyer of what should have been righteous people. And then later, in the third talk, or possibly in the prophetic events talk, we'll find out about how Babylon the Great, Rome of our day, has been an avid persecutor of the righteousness, and also a deceiver, a tricker of what the Bible really says. So this is kind of the point where I leave off. We've gone all the way through Genesis 11, all the history in Genesis 1 through 11, and poor Seth has to cover all the rest of the Old Testament in his talk. But the next thing that we'll talk about is Abraham's call and the promises made to him. So I'll just leave you with this chart here that shows Abraham's journey as he was called out of Ur of the Chaldees. And just try to keep in mind the context of events there. This is after Babel, the Tower of Babel occurs, which is in this area right here. Remember, Babel was the beginning of his kingdom, and Akkad was another one that mentioned there. There's Akkad. And so Abraham will make his journey out of that land of Nimrod's rod of iron into a land that God would show him.